Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries daily worldwide over the internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Once more, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, business, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the tyranny of experts right after this. You know, under the terms of a contract called the Old Covenant, it was negotiated by Moses out at Mount Sinai, you and I are entitled to 33 articulable benefits. Benefits such as rain in due season, multiplied gold, silver, herds, flocks, and great wealth. Well, our former president, George Bush, said when he was running for election that what Americans wanted was jobs, jobs, jobs. You know, that's not what George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, Moses, or God had in mind when they wrote our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, and the Ten Commandments. All of these authorities recognized that the real wealth is measured in land, cattle, property. It's measured in gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. It's not measured in jobs, jobs, jobs. And that's because there's no money in employment. The money is in private business. The money is in sales. It's not in public business, and it's certainly not in jobs, jobs, jobs. That's why I contend that it's time that you and I cash in on our inheritance and learn how to collect our benefits of this old covenant contract and to collect those benefits in real property, things like gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil, rather than credit, debt, usury, inflation, and worthless paper. Now, if you'd like to learn more about how to do just that, why don't you call for more information on our CD Home School for Adults. And while you're at it, order our free General Law CD package at the same time. Now, that CD package is free. You just call and ask for it, and we'll send you one, or you can download it off the Internet. The number to call if you're not on the Internet and you're listening on radio someplace, the number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can download it yourself right off your computer. Go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. And then click onto the Archives page, and you'll see that free General Law CD package there, and you can just download it or stream it, whichever you prefer. Hey, we're talking about paid professionals, the tyranny of experts. These paid professionals, you know, the doctors and the dentists and the bankers and lawyers and brokers and insurance agents and one thing and another. Well, one of their kind, one of their professionals, a guy by the name of Morris E. Chaffetz, M.D., he's also a psychiatrist. He wrote an article in the Psych News International in July of 1998, Volume 3, Number 2. And this guy's no lightweight by any stretch of the imagination. He was the, in fact, he still is. He's in drug and alcohol abuse. Morris E. Chaffetz, M.D., is the founding director of the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism in the United States. Pretty prestigious. And that's a governmental institution, by the way, in the Department of Health and Human Services. Now, he's currently president and founder of the Health Education Foundation, which is an organization that relates health to lifestyle in Washington, D.C. So he's a former government bureaucrat. He's a psychiatrist and a medical doctor. He is a professional. And his objective here, it's a little 10-page article that he wrote for the psychiatrist, and he said, let me tell you about the tyranny of the professions, tyranny of professionals. He wrote a little section down here about medical risk. You know, we read about that quite often, or you hear it on the news. You know, what's your risk of getting cancer? If you're smoking a pack a day, what's your risk? Or if you're drinking Jack Daniels, you know, what's your risk of getting this or that or something else? And I never thought much about it until I read this guy's article, because I thought that these guys had this issue pretty well put to bed. Come to find out, they don't know what they're talking about. They're hucksters, and they're selling their products. They're selling their goods. They're selling their services. They're selling their ideas. They're making money off of us by getting us to buy this, that, and another thing. And they're telling us, well, now, you know, you can reduce your risk of getting cancer if you'll do ABC. You can reduce your risk of getting a heart attack if you eat an aspirin a day. Oh, is that so? Well, did they ever give aspirin to a bunch of people and then withhold aspirin and then watch this for 20 or 30 years and see how many people that take aspirin got fewer heart attacks or? And the answer is no. But they tell us that. And we believe it. Why do we believe it? Well, because they're professionals. I remember old Frank Rocha. He came to the United States. Now, here's a guy, comes here. He said to me one time, he said, if you went to the Azores, you'd starve to death. You Americans could never make it over there. It's too tough. He said, but we Portuguese, we can come here to America, and it's easy. It's all downhill for us. I never had shoes, he told me, until he was 17 years old. Now, this guy was illiterate. He not only was illiterate in English, he was illiterate in Portuguese. This guy couldn't read and write. Came to the United States. He saved his money. 1944, he bought a dairy. In 1970, he died, or 71, and he had $1 million. Now, here's a guy that came to the United States when he arrived in New Bedford, Massachusetts, in 1922. He was born in 1900. He was 22 when he came to this country. He had $5 in his pocket. He got on a train in Massachusetts and rode it out to Lolita, California, where he had a job. And he went to work on a dairy there, working for a guy by the name of Nielsen. And he worked there from 1922 to 1944. He left there, and he went out on his own. He got a dairy, and then he went to work. He made $1 million. Now, that's pretty successful. And the guy's illiterate. I mean, he can't read. He can't write. Can you believe it? Right now, Americans, conversely, here we are. We've got PhDs driving taxi cabs in New York because they can't find a job, you know, doing whatever PhDs do. So we go to college, and we get all this education. We get to be real smart, but we never make $1 million. You've got thousands, maybe millions, but certainly thousands and thousands of young people coming out of college that owe billions and billions of dollars collectively in their school loans that they're going to be indebted to and paying off for the rest of their lives. And most of these people aren't going to pay these debts off. The taxpayers will pay them off to educate these people to become educated fools. That's what we're really dealing with here, is education that's gone to a level of foolishness until now we have educated fools. So in the last program, I said, now you got one group of educated fools telling us that the Big Bang Theory and evolution is true, accurate, and correct, and another group of educated fools, and they're measuring the sun to see how fast it's burning up. And when you do the arithmetic, you find that either one side or the other is lying to you. And I'm not here to tell you which side it is. I'm just telling you that the math doesn't add up. And so now here's a professional comes along and says, well, let me show you what I've discovered about this thing called medical risk. Listen to this. He says, risk is a concept central to the power of the medical experts. They want to reduce our risk of illness. But we have to ask, on what basis do they establish the risk associated with any particular behavior? Consider the concern over cancer risk. Biochemist Bruce Ames, who developed the widely used Ames test to determine whether particular environmental chemicals increase the risk of cancer, has repudiated the conclusions of much of his earlier research. So Dr. Ames goes out and he says, okay, let me show you how to calculate your medical risk of getting cancer. He works on that, and 30 years later he comes back and says, well, no, I'm going to repudiate the conclusions of my research. Ames now believes that one of the standard ways of testing carcinogenicity, getting cancer, giving rats megadoses of the substance in question, called the maximum tolerated dose, or the MTD, the maximum tolerated dose, ignores the fact that the body's reaction to a substance depends on the dosage taken in. You see, the body is efficient at neutralizing small doses of carcinogens and other toxins, but it becomes overwhelmed when large quantities are introduced all at once. Megadoses may approximate the amount taken into the body over the course of a year or so, but ingesting a year's dose in an hour invalidates the test and overstates the risk of cancer. Ames believes that the MTD tests could label as lethal over half of all chemicals, whether natural or manufactured. The newly founded panel on risk at the National Academy of Sciences agrees, in principle at least, with this assessment. As an example of the excesses that can result when this maximum, they call this the MTD, maximum tolerated dose, the MTD test could label as lethal. As an example of the excesses that can result from this testing is the primary method of determining risk, consider the case of dioxin, the chemical in Agent Orange. Dioxin, chemical Agent Orange. Dioxin was once pronounced the most dangerous substance on the face of the earth, and yet dioxin now appears to be less dangerous than was previously thought. Reinterpretation of the original animal studies shows that the danger was overestimated, and the only study to definitively link dioxin to excess cancer deaths found a slightly increased risk among 1,500 workers who had been exposed to 500 times the federally designated acceptable level, the highest exposure level in history. No increased risk of cancer was found in the same study among 3,500 workers who received an average of 90 times the acceptable level of exposure. So when 1,500 workers were exposed to 500 times the federally designated acceptable level, they found a little bit of increased cancer among those 1,500 above the general population. When they took another group of 3,500 workers and gave them 90 times, not 500 times, just 90 times the acceptable level of exposure, they didn't notice any increase at all. Now, you and I, we read these statistics in the paper, and there's always a conclusion that comes from the article. When we read the article, they give us the numbers, and then they come to a conclusion, and they say, this proves this or that. They tell us what it proves, and then we believe it. But you and I never do the arithmetic. We accept the numbers that they give us, and then we accept the conclusion that they give us, and we never check it out. Let me give you an illustration. Billy Graham. Billy Graham was a great preacher. He was very persuasive. But what I noticed was that Billy Graham, when he was on the podium in his younger days, you know, when he was really vibrant, he would hold the Bible in his hand, and he would say, the Bible says, you know, the Bible says, and then he would tell us what the Bible says. And I got to thinking about that, and I said, well, does the Bible really say that, or does Billy Graham say that the Bible says? So I started checking him out. And when I found that Billy Graham would say the Bible says, and then I would look it up, and the Bible didn't say that at all. And oftentimes it said the exact opposite. Here's an illustration. A guy by the name of Kent Hovind, great guy, preacher, Baptist. And he teaches about evolution and special creation, and I've got his tapes, and I like him, and I think he's just a great fellow. And then one day on one of his tapes, he said he couldn't find any place in the Bible that prohibited interracial marriage. Now, let me repeat that in case you missed this. Interracial marriage, that means black men marrying white women, or white women marrying an Oriental, or, you know, some combination of men and women of different races. Could be Hawaiians marrying whites, or Hawaiians marrying blacks, or Hawaiians marrying Japanese, or any combination looks like it. Interracial marriage. Does the Bible say anything about interracial marriage? And Kent Hovind said he couldn't find any place in the Bible that prohibited interracial marriage. Kent Hovind's been to theology school. You know, he's a smart guy. In fact, he's called Dr. Kent Hovind. He has a PhD. Well, at least he says he does. And I presume he does. And so if you were to ask me, is that Dr. Hovind smart? He's smarter than I am. Hell, I don't have a PhD. I was in a deposition the other day, and this guy asked me, you know, the lawyer, the opposing counsel, he said, how far did you go in school, Mr. Gordon? I said, hell, I'm a high school dropout. So I just wanted to let all you people out there know that, hell, I'm a high school dropout. Nope, don't, you know, rank me as being very smart over here. But I deny being brain dead. Now, I don't admit to being very smart, but by God, I deny that I'm brain dead. So while I only read 237 words a minute, I can understand all 237 words when I get done. See? And I didn't use that word get done accidentally there. I did it on purpose. It makes all you English smart guys out there real mad. You know, they write me letters and they say, you know, Gordon, if you could read, write, and speak the English language, you might have something intelligent to say. Well, let me tell you, boys and girls, that all of the plumbers, carpenters, and electricians out there and alcoholics on Main Street don't have any problems understanding what I'm telling them. And I can't speak for the rest of you guys from Harvard now. But all the Joe Sixpacks out there, they don't have any problems understanding what I'm telling them. And so this Kent Hovind over here, he says he can't find any place in the Scripture. Let me give you a couple, three of them, just off the top of my head. And I'm just a damn plumber now. And then I can show you from the Scripture here, it's against the law to marry outside your race. So let's start here with Deuteronomy 7, just to give you a little flavor of what we're talking about here. Deuteronomy 7, verses 1 through 6. Verse 3, neither shall you make marriages with them. Your daughter shall not give unto you, shall not give unto his son, nor his daughter shall you take unto your son, for they will turn away your son from following me, that they may serve other gods. So will the anger of the Eternal be kindled against you and destroy you suddenly. When the flood came up, this is in Genesis chapter 6, Noah was pure in his generations. Noah, pure in his generations, didn't have interracial mixtures. He was saved, everybody else died. Clue, thought I'd point that one out to you. Now, we flip over here to Ezra and Nehemiah, a couple of little books over here called Ezra and Nehemiah. Let's see if I can find them here. Yeah, here we go. Here's Ezra, chapter 9. Interracial marriage is prohibited. Write these down. You can read them for yourself. I don't want to get into interracial marriage. Deuteronomy 7, verses 1 through 3. Joshua 23, 10 through 13. Nehemiah 13, verses 23 through 27. Judges 3. Verses 5 through 7, Ezra, all of chapter 9, and all of chapter 10. And that's from a plumber, for crying out loud. So I can show you 5, 6, 8 places here in the Bible that tells you don't do that. I'm not here to advocate. I'm not here to tell you do it or don't do it. I just wanted to point out to you that these guys that have the papers, they're representing the Bible. Like Billy Graham, he comes along and he says, the Bible says, and then lies to you. I mean, it would seem like to me that he could come along and say, listen, the Reader's Digest says, and let's say to hell with the Bible. That's what you preachers ought to do. You ought to throw the Bible out and come into church with the Reader's Digest and then the Encyclopedia Britannica or Newsweek magazine or something like that, and then, you know, preach us a sermon and tell us what you think without telling us that this is what God is telling us, because you're liars. Well, you know, not all, but most of you preachers are a bunch of damn liars. Billy Graham's is right up the top of the bunch there. Now, going on here with these research statistics, you know, this is where they say your chances of getting cancer, your chances of having a heart attack are reduced if you eat this or eat that, or if you take this aspirin or you don't take this aspirin or do this, that, or something else. Well, now, dioxin was once pronounced, remember, the most dangerous substance on the face of the earth. But when they actually went out and tested this with 1,500 workers and 3,500 workers, they found out that when you give them more, that is, this maximum dose, you can actually create cancer. Well, I can understand that. You know, if we went out here and took a little bit of arsenic, you know, not too much, just a little bit. You know, arsenic is a metal. It's poison. And you need arsenic in your diet. Did you know that? Just like you need copper and iron and vitamins and various other minerals and boron, manganese and stuff like that, you need a little bit of arsenic. But if you take too much arsenic, it'll kill you. So if we give you a maximum dose, I mean, you know, we can really raise hell with you. But if we just give you the right amount, a little bit all the time, it's actually good for you. It doesn't harm you at all. It doesn't give you cancer. But we can give you enough that we can kill you. Same thing's true with water. You know, water is good for you, and you need a little water all the time. Give you a little bit too much, and we can drown you. Too much water isn't good for you. Now, this risk thing over here that we're talking about, sometimes risk is merely an artifact of our methods of assessment. Consider the case of human papillomavirus, suspected as a cause of cervical cancer because the virus has been found in some women, about 12% of women. And when you examine them, they have this papillomavirus, and they develop this disease. Well, recently, a new, more sensitive screening procedure was found, and it has found that the human papillomavirus is actually in 46% of women in routine gynecological testing. Researchers may now have to rethink their ideas about risk involving the virus and cervical cancer, because far more women who do not get cancer carry the virus than women who do get cancer. So it appears then that the risk of getting cervical cancer from human papillomavirus went down when better testing was developed, and that's the tyranny. Now, down in Texas, the governor down there, Rick Perry, signed a bill, and the pharmaceutical companies came in there based upon these tests now. And they said, we need to give every schoolgirl in Texas this shot, this vaccine, to prevent this cancer. Now we find out that half the women carry this virus anyway, and more of the women who carry the virus don't get cancer than do. That should tell us that there's no direct connecting link between this virus and cancer. But now we have a law that requires all of you girls that you get this vaccine, which, by the way, now has thimerosal in it. So now instead of 35 vaccines, we got 36. Now, if we keep doing this, we can probably give you autism. All right, now that's what this tyranny is all about. Now, I don't know whether or not you want this shot. I'm not telling you not to get the vaccine if that's what you want to do. What I'm opposed to and what I'm trying to report here is that what about those of us that don't want it? Could we just use our own common sense and decide for ourselves that, well, we're stupid. We're not as smart as all of you smart people out there. We just don't want the damn shot. Would it be all right with you if we just didn't do that? And the answer is hell no. See, these professionals absolutely insist that we live our lives according to their dictates. That's tyranny. Freedom, boys and girls, is made up of choices. And indeed, it may well be that the choices that you make are wrong choices. The world is full of people that make bad choices and drink too much booze. But you know, the alcoholic that's out here drinking booze and killing himself and giving himself cirrhosis of the liver, don't you think he should have the right to choose that wrong course of action? Because if you don't, well then, who's going to let you choose your course of action? And that's the point that we're trying to deal with here, is that, you know, if you want the shot, that's fine. And if you don't want the shot, that ought to be just real fine too. And all of you smart people out there can get the shots, and you can say, well, see, we're a lot smarter than you, can live longer than we do. And that'll prove your theory of evolution, because if all you smart people get the shot, and all of us dumb people don't, one or the other of us is going to live longer than the other and then outproduce the other, and then pretty soon, you know, you can get rid of all of us dummies out here, and all of you smart people that have all these vaccinations, you know, can be rocking back and forth in your chairs with your autism. And, you know, not to make light of it, but, you know, the ultimate end is going to be, I often tell my students, says, you know, you guys get excited about this sodomy thing. You don't need to get excited about sodomy at all. It's a natural phenomenon that cures itself. All sodomites die young. First of all, sodomites don't reproduce. That's number one. And number two, the average sodomite dies at age 45, unless he dies from AIDS, in which case he dies at age 39, statistically. The rest of us live to be 75 or 80. And we produce, we reproduce. All you got to do is sit back and relax. The sodomites will all kill themselves. So what are you excited about? Here's what the problem is. We allow the sodomites to come in and pervert our children and tell us that sodomy is an alternative lifestyle. And then we're prohibited from telling our children and telling others that sodomy is an abomination and God prohibits it. They can present their views. We cannot present our views. Free speech is for sodomites. Free speech is not for Christians, not for anti-sodomites. Well, it would seem like to me that just in the interest of fairness, that free speech ought to be available to everybody. And that those that are opposed to sodomy ought to be able to have fair and equal time to present their views. And the sodomite should have fair and equal time to present his views. And then you and I, the customer, can decide, well, which view do we want to follow? What is it that we want to do? But that isn't the way the game is being played. Suddenly, the legislature comes into the equation, and they pass laws, and they call it hate crime legislation. And they say, if you say anything that's anti, why, then we're going to lock you up in jail. If you say it pro, that's fine. That's okay. So you can go out here and you can preach sodomy until the cows come home, and that's fine. You come out here and open your mouth and say something that's negative about sodomy, and we're going to throw your ass in prison. That's what they do in Canada and Germany. And it won't be long until they're doing it here in the United States and probably around the world. So I thought I'd bring it to your attention. You know, right's right and wrong is wrong. That's the bottom line. And the guy that wants to make the wrong decision, why do we want to get in his way? How come he can't make his wrong choice? Sodomites want to make a wrong choice. So why should I get in the way and prevent them from making their choice? Now, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review, and we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. That's for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling the law school and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, click onto the archives page and download it right there, georgegordon.org, archives page, punch the button and download it. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or the publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind now that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and editorial review, they may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program, they're mine alone, they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing a periodical here. The periodical is called the Psych News International, Volume 3, Issue 2. It is entitled The Tyranny of Experts by Morris E. Chaffetz, C-H-A-F-E-T-Z, M-D. Now, this is also written in book form. So let me flip over here to the book form, where it's excerpted from his book. The article is excerpted and adapted with the author's permission from The Tyranny of Experts, Blowing the Whistle on the Cult of Expertise, published by Madison Books, New York, 1996. The ISBN number is 1-56833-064-2. 1995, U.S. dollars, available through National Book Network, 1-800-462-6420. Again, that's 1-800-462-6420. 6420. Quite a story the guy is laying out here. Remember, he's a professional, and he said, I've been doing the same thing, but when it was done to me, it hit home. And the deception, you know, here's a guy who's a psychologist, a psychiatrist, medical doctor, and he's objecting to the deception by the paid professionals, you know, the clergy. And yet he's out here, you know, making his own deceptions. One day he wakes up and he says, you know, all of us professionals are deceivers. That's what I've come to the conclusion many years ago, and I thought I'd pick up on that and say, here's an insider making the very same argument that I've been making now for the last 30 years. Now let's talk about the manufacture of victims. When tragedy strikes, being able to identify an innocent victim as someone who is subject to the whims of fate, dependent, unsuspecting, blameless, is a convenient label. A victim, therefore, presents no ambiguities and no confusing questions of responsibility to weigh and feel troubled about. The victim is innocent, therefore someone or something else must be responsible. You know, we see that quite often. We look at innocent victims, you know, when you're talking about someone being killed in a traffic accident. Or we think about the victims of the trade towers, you know, on 9/11. We say, my God, they're all innocent victims. Well, innocent of what? You know, what? Or guilty of what? Maybe they were guilty, but maybe we didn't know what their guilt was. Maybe we didn't have all the facts. Well, when something bad happens to an innocent victim, and especially one from those groups that society views as being vulnerable, children are one, women a second, the elderly are third, then our social guardians, the paid professionals, social aid and so on, will feel justified in venting their most primitive emotions. I recall the pure anger of a store owner in New Hampshire, for example, when a four-year-old girl that he didn't know was killed by a drunk driver. 4 years old, he kept saying, like a litany. 4 years old. She was only 4 years old. And he became angry with me when I asked him whether it would have been different if the person killed had been an adult. In other words, you got a drunk driver driving down the road, runs over and kills a four-year-old kid. And you get excited and you get emotional about that. Now, if this same drunk driver was driving down the road and he hit a hobo, a bum, you know, just some old stumble bum who was living down along the tracks and he was walking down the road one day and the drunk driver hit him, would you care as much? So we're really not suggesting that we care about human life. We're suggesting that we care about little children, human life, which is far superior to an old man or a poor old man. Well, okay, now we can extrapolate that out and say, well, we had these floods over in Pakistan, and 20 million people are homeless, but you know they're all Muslims and they're all adults, and you know, so why should we care? Well, we don't. So what they do to arouse our emotions, they show us little children. And I'm just asking the question, well, don't adults feel bad? Don't they suffer? Don't they have pain? Don't they have anguish and suffering just like children do? So why is it that we don't have the same empathy for the people who have been displaced and their houses have been destroyed and so on? And then furthermore, another thing that I'm kind of wondering about, not to belittle you Muslims out there by any means, but I have been observing for many, many years now. And I observe that Muslims seem to be taking it on the short end of the stick more often than the Christians and other people in the world. For instance, have you noticed how often, like in Indonesia, we have tsunamis that kill a quarter of a million people, or we have volcanoes that go off and disrupt life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, or we have earthquakes that destroy villages and cities, and we have in Pakistan a flood that has now displaced 20 million people and destroyed all of the food supplies for 175 million. And I look at that and I say, where is Allah in all of this? I mean, surely, you people have been tested enough by now, haven't you? I mean, if it's Allah testing you to see how faithful you're going to be, I mean, you know, is there ever a limit? Does Allah ever bless you people and give you enough to eat and maybe, you know, a little surplus? I just take a look at all the Muslim people in the world. They look like they're just about dirt poor. You got the elite in Saudi Arabia. And there's a guy in Saudi Arabia that's so rich that he had a horse, and he wanted to put this horse into the Kentucky Derby. So he flew him over here on his 747. He's a Muslim with a 747 and a penchant for racing his horse in the Kentucky Derby. That's one extreme. And then you take a look at the poor over there, and this is what they show us on TV over here. I don't know how accurate that is, but my view of the Muslims is that they're all dirt poor, just barely scratching out a living. And so I got to say, you know, just as one old farmer to another, you know, the guy over there in the valley who got his farm wiped out, I know how I would feel if my farm got wiped out by a flood. So when this fellow here, this psychiatrist, brings this up and says, now listen, these guys are playing on our emotions here, and they're selling us something. They want to sell us charity. They sell us charity. Won't you give to the Haitian Relief Fund? Won't you give to the Tsunami Fund? Won't you give to this or that fund? Now, I'm not opposed to giving money to this or that fund to help this guy who's lost his farm in Pakistan. Here's what I'm opposed to. They bring the little children out, and they show us these little children, say, for 25 cents a day, you can feed this little child. Won't you sign up today and pledge $100 a year for this goal? And we do. And then we find out that 90% of this money goes to this charity, to raising funds and supporting their staff. And then 10% goes, maybe 10% goes to feeding these little children. And then you and I, you know, just Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife out here, are asked to support this kind of crap. Now let me show you a little something here. I'm going to cut into my story. I got this over the internet the other day, and it illustrates this point. A Japanese company, Toyota, and an American company, General Motors, decided to have a canoe race on the Missouri River. Both teams practiced long and hard to reach their peak performance before the race. On the big day, the Japanese won by a mile. The Americans were very discouraged and depressed, and they decided to investigate the reason for the crushing defeat. A management team made up of senior management was formed to investigate and recommend appropriate action. Their conclusion was that the Japanese had 8 people rowing and 1 person steering, while the American team had 7 people steering and 2 people rowing. Feeling that a deeper study was in order, American management hired a consulting company, and they paid them a large amount of money for a second opinion. They advised, of course, that too many people were steering the boat, while not enough people were rowing. Well, not being sure of how to utilize that information, but wanting to prevent another loss to the Japanese, the rowing team's management structure was totally reorganized to 4 steering supervisors, 2 area steering superintendents, and 1 assistant superintendent steering manager. They also implemented a new performance system that would give the 2 people rowing the boat greater incentive to work harder. It was called the Rowing Team Quality First Program, with meetings, dinners, and free pens for the rowers. There was discussion of getting new paddles, canoes, and other equipment, extra vacation days for practices and bonuses. The pension program was trimmed to equal the competition, and some of the resultant savings were channeled into morale-boosting programs and teamwork posters. The next year, the Japanese won by 2 miles. Humiliated now, the American management laid off 1 rower, halted development of a new canoe, sold all of the paddles, and canceled all of the capital investments for new equipment. The money saved was then distributed to the senior executives as bonuses. The next year, try as he might, the lone designated rower was unable to even finish the race because he had no paddles. So he was laid off for unacceptable performance. All of the canoe equipment was sold, and the next year's racing team was outsourced to India. Sadly, there's something else to think about. General Motors has spent the last 30 years moving many of its factories out of the United States, claiming that they could not make money paying American wages. The Toyota company, however, has spent the last 30 years building more than a dozen automobile plants inside the United States and hiring U.S. workers. Now, in the last quarter's results, the Toyota Corporation makes $4 billion in profits, while General Motors racked up a $9 billion loss. General Motors, folks, are still scratching their heads, and they're still collecting their bonuses. You know, if this weren't so true, it might even be funny. Now, going back here to the story that we're talking about here, you know, the professionals keep giving us this advice. But the results that we get from listening to this professional result, or this professional advice, is leading us to national destruction. You know, outsourcing these jobs to India, free trade, inviting the Japanese into America, while the Americans move, the Buick company, by the way, has now been totally removed to China. When you buy a Buick automobile in the United States today, it is made in China with Chinese labor. No Americans involved. So I'd throw that one out there, too. Now, victims, you know, victims. And so we say, well, the American worker now is a victim. Excuse me, boys and girls, don't all of these American workers vote? Isn't it the unions here in America that's voting for the Democrats? I mean, the unions always support the Democrats, don't they? Wasn't the World Trade Organization passed by Bill Clinton and the Democrats? You know, I'm not sitting here, you know, heaping horse pucky, you know, on Democrats. I just wanted to point out that there's a conclusion, there's a result that has come from free trade. And, you know, the Republicans and the Democrats have been working as hard as they can over the last 50 years to give us free trade. Now we've got it. They have dismantled all of our tariffs. Our founding fathers gave us tariffs to support our government, and our politicians have given us the income tax to support government. I think that foreigners selling their products in America, I think Toyota should be made in Japan, shipped to America, and they pay tariffs on it and support the government. Okay, I just wanted to point out that the victim isn't necessarily the victim because of nothing that he's done himself. He usually is the proximate cause of his own injury. We, the people of America, are the proximate cause of our own injury. We have voted these politicians in one election after another. A little guy with big ears, you know, floppy ears, named Ross Perot, ran for president in 1992. Do you remember that little guy from Texas? And he said, boys and girls, if you carry this out, you're going to destroy your economy. And we said, to hell with you, Perot, and we voted in Bill Clinton, didn't we? Twice. Hey, that little guy from Texas was right, wasn't he? So I don't see the workers at General Motors as being victims. You know, they had their choices, just like we had our choices. Now, all you people out there just got through voting for Harry Reid out there in Nevada. Hey, Harry Reid was in on this deal. You Republicans voting for George Bush and the Republicans, they were in on this deal. George Bush has been working on this outsourcing of jobs and free trade. And the last time I picked up a paper, we're still espousing free trade and globalization. The people of America have not figured out yet that globalization and free trade has destroyed your economy. Now, going on here talking about this thing of victims, it also provides society with a simple way to think about complex social problems. When dealing with the problems of drugs, crime, poverty, traffic, fatalities, and other social problems, our surrogate parents, the experts, the politicians, remember the experts, seem to provide easy and fast solutions. Our social guardians focus their expertise on devising protective social policies for innocent victims, but they neglect to deal with the underlying problems. They succeed in giving comfort in two ways. First, their agenda allows other people to distance themselves from the plight of the victims. Second, by making the victim an emotional symbol, they can further their larger agenda, that is, power and conformity. They define the situation as something that can be solved by simply finding and punishing the person or thing that they view as being responsible. The manufacturer of the label victim encourages a simplistic view of the world. It turns the world into good guys and bad guys, victims and victimizers, the innocent and the culpable. Life, however, is rarely that neat and simple. In seeing only black and white and ignoring the gray under the guise of protecting the innocent, great harm can be done. And indeed, when we talk about globalization, great harm has been done. Now, the professionals at Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, you know, they all went into the Congress and they said, we got to bail out the banks. We got to bail out the system. Well, excuse me, boys and girls, but who was it that created these banks? Wasn't it the Federal Reserve System back in 1913? How many Americans do you know of have been championing gold and silver coin, the abolishing of the Federal Reserve, and going back to practicing hard money versus fiat currency? Can you name anybody? Well, other than Ron Paul. You know, there's just one, we've only got one champion out there, and he's Ron Paul. One lonely voice out of 435 guys in the House of Representatives. Now, our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention put in 17 words in our Constitution that says, no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. And that was a principle of law that is taken from the Bible. It says, thou shalt not steal, which is supported by two statutes. The statute in Leviticus 19, 35 and 36, and the statute in Deuteronomy 25, verses 13 through 16, tell us not to use unjust weights and balances. Now, boys and girls, you and I view ourselves as being victims of this global financial crisis. Hell, we're not the victims, we're the perpetrators of it. We're the people that voted it in, time after time after time after time. We vote for Republicans and we vote for Democrats. Those are the two political parties that created this global financial crisis. It would seem like to me that we should wake up and vote in some third party. And then what do I hear? They say, oh, well then, third parties can't get elected. So therefore, I'm going to vote for the Republican or the Democrat and I'm going to hold my nose. You're going to, what? We just had an election here in the United States. And here in Missouri, we had two candidates. One of them is a pork barrel Republican who practices earmarks, and the other is a gun-grabbing Democrat. And the the Republican won out. So we're going to have more pork barrels, but we can keep our guns. If we'd have voted in the other guy, we would have still had the pork barrels, but we might have lost our guns. So the people held their nose and they made a vote. Why didn't we vote in some third party? I made this observation. I'm going to stick with it. The two candidates running for the Senate here in Missouri, neither one of them were competent or qualified to represent Joe Sixpack and Sally Onswife. They were more than competent at managing and representing Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, or the Democratic or the Republican parties, or the establishment, or the powers that be, or the World Bank, or God knows who else. But they weren't competent or qualified to represent George Gordon or Sally Housewife or Joe Sixpack. They weren't there for that purpose. And so the Joe Sixpacks and the Sally Housewives all went out there and voted in this other guy, you know, the guy that they wanted. Now, next time we'll take up smoking, and I'll give you a little insight as to the smoking over here, but I want to point out that you and I are not victims. We are the proximate cause of our own injury. We, the electorate, could have voted in some third party if we so desired. We did not desire to do that, and we didn't. And we're going to get more of the same. More of the same. And then we're going to point to ourselves and say, oh my God, look how many of us are unemployed now. And then you'll blame it on the Republicans. And then you'll vote the Democrats back in. See? You got Team A and you got Team B. And so when Team A screws you over, you vote in Team B, and they screw you over, and so you vote Team A back in. They screw you over, and you vote in Team B. Has anybody ever come to the conclusion that maybe we need Team C, D, or E? Just a wild new thought. The Republicans and the Democrats have screwed you, blued you, and tattooed you, and now you call yourself a victim. I deny that. I'm not a victim. Hey, I'm out of time, so let me remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives, and all of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.